This is part two of the István Deák interview recorded December 5th, 2009.
And that my mother was had no profession, that she's finished some kind of a middle school but not a gymnasium, which would have been very rare for girls. There were some gymnasia already, but not for many, and mostly for the aristocracy or for the Budapest Jewish intelligentsia. But after all, my mother grew up in Székesfehérvár, and from a family that could not have had much money, although I don't know anything about them. In any case, she was a wife and a mother, which at that time was considered adequate. Nobody ever said, why don't you do something? But what did she do? And this is what I cannot answer, because after all, we had maid, and the maid did all the jobs at work at home. My mother supervised it. But the supervision could not have been a full-time occupation. It wasn't. I know that every morning we went to school, and then my mother was at home. My father had left, of course, for work also. My mother was at home, and mostly I knew that she was in the bathroom talking on the telephone to her sister. There were three, one brother and two sisters, but the two sisters were very close, and every morning they talked on the telephone. Then afterwards, as I know, although I very rarely witnessed this, my mother got dressed and gave instructions to the maid on what to cook for lunch and dinner, basically. And then she left. And she went, what the expression was, megyek komisiózni. Komisiózni. Commissions. Well, she had to buy a hat, she had to buy stockings, she had to buy something for my father, she had to buy something for us. But every day, every single day she went commissioned. And that's what apparently she did. So I'm firmly convinced, and so is my sister, although she is more cautious in this, that mother must have had her own life, of which we know nothing. All we know is that when my sister was already a young girl, already of marriageable age, very many young men came to our house to court her. But I noticed that many of these young men were not that young, and that they really came to see my mother. Now, what that amounted to, whether they just found my mother much more amusing, much more interesting, much more charming than my sister, who was serious, whereas my mother was very flirtatious and charming and amusing, and behaved exactly as you would find in American comedies of this time and how a lady behaves, I cannot tell. Or maybe they came because they were really in love with my mother or had something to do with my mother. I cannot answer. In any case, I don't know anything about them and consequently about her private life, and consequently I don't know anything about her. I know that she was very nice to me, loving to me, and cared for me and worried about me, but what she thought about all this. I know that I had fights with my father all the time, mostly about money, because we had very little money, and my mother, especially in view of the other family members, immediate relatives, who were very well off, was rather bitter about it, that we cannot afford this and we cannot afford that. Although we could afford quite a few things, because my grandfather came to our rescue. And so every summer we were traveling as children, mostly to Austria. 1932, 33, 34, 36, 37, I was in Austria for the whole summer, for 4 weeks, first with family members, then as an exchange kid, not an exchange, as a kid who was high, sort of sent to a family to the mountains. And I didn't need to practice my German because my German was fluent. But to speak, to be in a German atmosphere, German-speaking atmosphere. My father's mother tongue was German because his own mother came from Rohons, that is today Austria, who spoke better Austrian German actually, than Hungarian. My father was absolutely bilingual, and I was more or less, as a child, I was also bilingual, I guess. I forgot some German because I practice it so less often. But for me, it made no difference ever whether I was speaking German or Hungarian all through my, mostly through my life. My mother also spoke some French. My father spoke very good French and always tried to learn some English and knew some English, but English wasn't that popular at that time. French was the language. A cultivated person had to know French, and of course, inevitably, it was the lingua franca was German. Not every Hungarian knew German, which shows that especially Hungarian gentry, country, middle class, Christian middle class, did not know German, which was a huge disadvantage. Again, I'm sort of skipping to another area. If you ask me why there is so much anti-Semitism in Hungary, it is inherited from a long time ago. One of this is that the Jews spoke German, and the Hungarians had to learn German. And many of them did learn, the aristocracy, of course, learned, those who were in government service, army officers. But many others couldn't learn it or learn it badly, spoke it with horrible accents. And therefore, for the imperial administration, for instance, Jews were preferable to non-Jews because the Jews were more cultivated generally. They had Western connections and they spoke the language, they spoke German. So even in the army, which I studied, I know on how, despite some anti-Semitism, how much easier was for a Jewish non-commissioned officer to get into an office where he spoke, could use his language abilities, as opposed to a peasant non-commissioned officer who spoke only Hungarian, and even that a dialect, and therefore he had to be sent to the front because that's what he was good for. The result is that more Christians, proportionally more Christians died than Jews. But that's one, definitely in my opinion, one reason for this endless envy that Hungarians feel for the Jews whom they torture, persecute, kill, but they still envy them. Now, since we are talking about this business, which is inevitable, about anti-Semitism, let me go back to our assimilation process. Apparently in 1926, just around the time when I was born, my father decided, and at this I know that he decided because he talked about it a little bit, he decided that he would convert, that we should convert. Why? Because he saw that if you are living in Hungary and if you want to be a genuine Hungarian, as he is, a highly decorated officer, then one should speak, not only speak the language and know the culture, but one should be one of it. And that's the way to do it, is to convert. So I'm born a Christian because I was a baby when I was baptized. And that, of course, then influences my whole life and causes me all my confusion and misery and mess, while at the same time it's not disadvantageous in every respect, that I live a life, I grow up in one culture, in one belief, while becoming aware at the age of 12, only at the age of 12, of my real origin. And that real origin, which is at that time not an origin to be proud of, but an origin that to be ashamed of, and an origin that might kill you. And so you belong to the master race because you are Hungarian, because you are middle class, because you are Christian, because your friends are Christians, because you are taught in school and hear day and night about us, the nation, the heroic Hungarian nation, even here about the soldiers and the officers and that you are going to be and that your parents were or your father was, and then be aware of the fact that there is only at the age of 12 and afterwards when already the first anti-Jewish legislation is introduced that you are the worst of the pariahs. Because even a pariah has, after all, an expectation, a hope that maybe one day it will get better, that he will be a little bit less discriminated against. So that's, for instance, what the Roma today must feel. Yes, it's very bad. In fact, there's a setback since communism. But inevitably, if the blacks in America can make a president, then inevitably a gypsy one day will also be president of Hungary. But for us, it was not only a setback, it was the end. It was clear that it will never get better. So now what do you do? Of course, I didn't ask this question myself because the family decided for me. the family decided that we have to act as if nothing would have happened. And we should be living like everybody else. We should continue our hopeful careers. We should not reconvert. We should not sink back to that world into which we had just emerged. We should definitely not become Zionists, because even Jews rejected Zionism almost unanimously. So then what should you do? I think about this all the time. Was I unfaithful to something to which I had never personally belonged? Would it have been more correct to reconvert? But why should I reconvert to a religion that didn't attract me, and that, except that it was a little bit like Christianity, but Christianity seemed to be somewhat better, something which added to the Old Testament, which is full of horrors and injustices and passions and cruelties and totally insane God who smites down people for no reason whatsoever and extols others. And now we have Christianity who rewards the good and at least admonishes the bad to improve themselves. The Christianity is a very great, with all its miseries and faults, is a very great idea. And I was profoundly devoted to it. So when I think of it, that, well, I should have been more honest and admit that I don't belong in this Christian world and somehow reconvert, although I don't, never heard of anyone in the whole world who would have reconverted. I have to also consider that I was a very religious person. I profoundly believed in Hungary and believed in the Catholic religion. I practiced it. I confessed my sins once a week, I would say. I took the Eucharist once a week. I prayed fervently. I went to the Cistercian Abbotry and stayed there the whole summer, sort of a trying out life as a novice. I lived among the Hardis, for instance, who were profoundly Catholic. And I have absolutely no idea whether I went wrong or not, and whether I should have behaved differently. Except that here in America, for instance, I'm very much aware of the fact that the people who converted are considered traitors. And they sort of wonder why I would not live up to the standards set by my ancestors. But the ancestors, I don't know that they set standards for me. I don't know who set. My own parents did. And my parents' idea was that one has to be what one wants to be, and one wants to be a decent Catholic Hungarian. Now, was I rejected by Hungarian society? I had, again, to answer this would take me a month. But definitely there were instances when I was made feel different. One becomes extremely sensitive, and so there are periods when I felt rejected, and there are periods when I felt exalted. Examples, for instance, yes, I was admitted to the Catholic gymnasium. But why was I admitted? I wasn't admitted to several other Catholic schools to which I applied and which rejected me. And of course, then the explanation was because I didn't know about my past yet. I was 10. I only found out at the age of 12. My parents' explanation was, well, there are too many applicants. But it could not have been true, because my father was a veteran, army veteran, which is in favor of you. He had the money to pay the tuition. He came from very acceptable milieu, middle-class milieu. We had a very good professor, a title, a diploma engineer. And I was an excellent student in elementary school. I was by far the best student in the whole school. So I should have been admitted to the Pieristak and the Premontrejek and the others, but I wasn't. And the only school that admitted me was the Cistercians. And now I realize that the Cistercians admitted me only, despite my religion, but in view of my origin, only because my father had already been a student in a Cistercian gymnasium run by Cistercian monks. So here is my first time when I profit from my being different from the run-of-the-mill population within my minority group. And this repeats itself again and again and again. That one, in the misery, one is has privileges. So I'm admitted, and they treat me absolutely decently. Nobody ever made me feel that that's exaggerated. My teachers never made me feel, even that is exaggerated. Most of my teachers did make me feel that I was different. But then there are a few instances when you may make you feel that you are different, and that burns into you, and that stays with you forever. Examples, being admitted to the Szent Imre Gymnasium, Szent Imre, 25 Szent Imre Cserkész Csapat, which is one of the Catholic Boy Scout groups, a very big group, fairly well known, hundreds of students belong to it, and of my gymnasium, and I wasn't admitted first. Then I was admitted. And soon I found out that by this time I'm 12, so I already know about my blemish in my past, that first they didn't want to admit me because they tried to be Aryan, not only Catholic, but Aryan. This is race begin to play a role. But that's Lorán Zsigmond, who was one of our teachers, who was the commanding general of the Boy Scouts in Hungary, in our school, he made a point of having me admitted. He made a big thing out of it that the son of an army officer who has a silver vitézségi medal for bravery should be admitted to the Boy Scout. A few years later, we are in Szigliget. No, not Szigliget. We are in Imatra, in a Boy Scout camp. As we every summer we went to Boy Scout camp. Last about 3 weeks, and we stand at night, and there is a prayer, last night prayer, and the flag is being lowered. We sing the national anthem and all these things that Boy Scouts were supposed to do. And meanwhile, my neighbor, who is Zsoltán Rozsnyai, I remember that very well, who is became a composer and a conductor and died here in America as the head of the Philharmonica Hungarica, he was telling jokes. And we were all laughing in the middle of the prayer. It's night, don't see people, so he goes. And suddenly there is a light shone on us, and our group commander, who was a Cistercian monk, points at me. We all laugh, but he points at me and he says, "There, get out of the line. You don't belong to us. Nem vagy te közöbbünk való. You don't fit here." And I know why he said it, because he was anti-Semitic, and he automatically singled me out. And as I said, I never forgot it. That was 70 years ago. So things like this, nothing worse than this type happened occasionally, very seldom. But it makes a person very much aware of his own problem and also sort of destroys him. So I feel that this, that he threw me out of the line without me by being more guilty than the others, we should not have laughed. But after all, I mean, we were giggling. You can't even stop giggling when you are ordered, everybody else is giggling around you. I was a very good student. I was a very devout student. I was a good boy. I was never really disorderly. And I had no disciplinary problems with me, partly because I was aware of the fact of how much more effort I have to make than the others in order to be acceptable. That makes me feel how much I understand blacks, for instance, when they are in a white milieu, and how much effort they have to make, whether they're playing baseball or doing something else, that they have to be much better than the others in order to be treated as equals. And I made much more effort, and yet this bastard rejected me in front of the others. I don't say that the others knew why he said, "You don't belong among us." But I understood, and he knew very well what he was saying. He came to America after the war. He was in Dallas, Texas. There was a sister's monastery. That's all. I mean, I always hope that I will confront him one day, but he wouldn't have remembered it, and I would not have said anything. Hope? So that's actually what I can see in terms of whether they was discriminated against or not. But there was this everyday problem. Once I was aware of it, and once the Jewish, anti-Jewish laws were out, and I belonged to a world, I was part of the world in which everybody was by this time, they were called an Aryan. Are you going to behave like the other Aryans, like the Aryans? Or are you going to behave differently? Are you going to show your non-converted, non-quite assimilated Jewish relative to the others? Are you going to invite them to a party? Oh, I have a picture here, but I will show it to you later. Your cousin who is clearly Jewish looking, are you going to invite him when everybody else is non-Jewish? And say, that's my relative. And Budapest society was very tolerant, and if you would have said, here is a friend who is Jewish, or everybody understood he was Jewish, but doesn't belong to you, he would have been very well said, oh, how nice, Deak invites non-Jews. Or my sister had much more of this problem than I had. But if you, turns out that the person is your relative, then the others, no matter how tolerant or liberal they are already aware of the fact that you are somehow contaminated. And even if they are doubly nice, you feel worse. And that's again what the blacks must feel in this country. If a person is a white, well, felt, they no longer have this problem in the same way. But let's say 20 or 30 years ago, if a white man is very nice to a black man, he feels insulted. I understand why he feels insulted, because he knows it's not normal behavior. They make an effort, and then once you make, the other one makes an effort, the whole thing is worthless. When am I going to be totally accepted? I so much sympathize with members of minorities, of course. Oriental minorities, no less of a problem than to be a black, for instance, or to be a Jew in some countries. But it fills your life, it determines your life forever. So, I'm there in school. My parents are very much aware of the war, of course. We have discussions at home. What are we going to do? How much is this going to affect our livelihood? It really didn't, because as you probably also know, the anti-Jewish legislation was not always taken literally or very seriously. And had it been taken seriously, especially the second, so-called second law and third law, life would have been much harder for the Jews in general. But it was violated. So that again makes you wonder about Hungarian society. On the other hand, you think nothing but anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic incidents, anti-Semitic statements, insanely anti-Semitic newspapers, horrible statements made in the parliament. On the other hand, you are aware of the fact that the Hungarian economy functioned only because Jews were kept during the war. Until 1944, they were still running the economy, and because many Jews, for one reason or another, with one excuse or another, maintained their positions, were maintained in their jobs. So then we have this incredible situation that in 1944, March 1944, when the Germans come into Hungary, there are over 800,000 Jews who are still free. Nobody prevents them from leaving their house. They are not living in assigned quarters. They eat in the best restaurants. They go on vacation in the summer those who can afford it, many are poor, others are less poor, some are unbelievably rich, they eat in restaurants, they live more an assimilated life or a freer life than American Negroes, because my father came back from America and he told horror stories about what happens here in the blacks and even to Jews. He said Jews are not admitted to hotels, they cannot go on vacation places, they cannot join clubs. About the blacks, he said he was in a New York restaurant and there were two men sitting next to him in another table, and the waiter came and kicked them out, just told them, leave. And they, without any protest, they left. And he said, well, they looked to him like white men. And his American host said, no. You could see that they have a little black blood. And they asked the waiter, and the waiter said, they're octoroons, 1/8 blacks. And they were thrown out in a New York restaurant that was absolutely common. Oh, I'm sorry. Where did you see a black in America? Where did you see an American black in a film, in a movie? They're only waiters. Waiters, nurses, servants, railroad, never a railroad conductor. Look at the old films about traveling. Never a conductor. There's no such thing as a black conductor. Only a funny character in the restaurant car. The cook, or the assistant cook, that's a black one. So the role played by blacks in American society, American films at least, is much more humiliating than the role played by Jews, even in German Nazi society. Because they were seen as powerful enemies by the Germans, although many of them were still tolerated up to World War II and even up to 1941. But the black is always in a humiliating role, as in Gone with the Wind, the nurse, the fat nurse. You joke about them, and they are funny characters. It's really extraordinary. And we were aware of that, and my father talked about it, that with all our problems, we felt we are part of a society that in many ways is more tolerant and more progressive than American society. What we didn't have, and we should have been much more aware of it, is what I already mentioned before, that in America, a black man had hope. If not he, then his children and grandchildren. It can only get better. And it did get better. Whereas for us, there was no hope, because it was clear, increasingly clear, that they want to get rid of you. How far they want to go in this ridding off process, and when is that going to happen? Are they going to wait to the end of the war for a peaceful departure, which we certainly could not even envisage? I didn't want to live outside Hungary. Or is it going to be violent? That we didn't know. What then happens after March 19? That's when the great disillusionment comes, because then it turns out that the majority of society doesn't care how, but wants you to disappear. And there are many exceptions, thousands of exceptions, and many lives are spared, including mine, but still this is a society which decided that it no longer wants you to be there, and in fact doesn't want to have minorities any longer. Because after all, I'm very much aware and keep thinking of what happened to the Germans after the war. The treatment might have been less violent, but it amounted to the same thing. This is a society that wants to be on its own, and that's exactly what's happening today. The right wing wants to be Hungarians, Hungary for the Hungarians. Now why, considering that there is no such thing really as a Hungarian, because every Hungarian has the blood of innumerable tribes and ethnic groups and in its own blood, I cannot answer. But there is a mania of thinking that among the Poles and among the Slovaks and among the Romanians and among the Hungarians, that there is such a thing as a pure race, and nobody else but members of that pure race should belong to it. Then I look at people in Budapest and say, this is Jesus, these are the Hungarians. What makes them Hungarian? Nothing that would make them Hungarian. It's really incredible. Because you see in Scandinavia, these are Scandinavians. They look like Scandinavians. You can see in among Italians, maybe they look sort of Mediterranean. But what the hell do Hungarians look like? There's absolutely no way of determining why this one is supposed to be Hungarian. Why can't he be an Austrian or a Slovak or a Croat or whatever? And in fact, he turns out to be a Croat, or he has a Croat name. And my classmates, I don't know how many of my classmates assimilated during those 8 years and changed from Slavic names to Hungarian names. I could list them, because I know my classmates by heart. And Gyuraveti becomes Gyarmati, and Heinrich becomes Harmat. Oh, many Germans, of course. German names are converted into Hungarian, and they're reconverted into German. I had a classmate by the name Jandl. He changed to Jani. In 1944, he became Jandl again, and ended up in Germany as Jandl. Not everybody changed his name, but I would say at least we were 60 more, approximately 16 in my class. At least 10 or 15 changed their names while I was during those 8 years. Did that mean that more Hungarian? Was Heinrich Harmat more Hungarian than Trautmann, who never changed his name? I really can't think. But that was certainly a major consideration in schools. So the problem is that Jews, the same problem that Christians face is there, but much more intensified. If you are a Schwab in my class and hear anti-Swabian statements, which they could have heard all the time, because there was very strong anti-Swabian prejudice, then you might have been angry and offended. But you were angry and offended in the name of an ethnic group that has a huge brother. So it's never, doesn't seem dangerous, at least until 1945. They call you a dirty Schwab, not dirty Schwab, what do they call them? Rohat Schwab. He might feel offended, but he doesn't have to be afraid, at least until 45. He didn't have to be afraid that he will be persecuted because he's just a Schwab. If you call somebody a toad, well, it's not very nice if you call him, especially if you call him Büdös Olá. It's not nice and it can be unpleasant, but it's not the same thing as they say Büdös Zsidó, because the Zsidó has no protection. And he knows that nobody will help him. So I think that it's just a question of the intensification of these feelings of fear on the one side and contempt on the other side. But it's not unique, just as the treatment of the Jews was not unique, because after all, Germans were also expelled after the war. The middle classes and the upper classes were mistreated after the war. In Hungary, almost everybody at one point was mistreated by the others. But it's only really a question of intensity. Now, 1945 changes, of course, brings a huge change because leadership roles are reversed, and in fact Hungary becomes the only country in Europe and perhaps in the world outside of Israel which is led by Jews for a short time, but a few years, but those are not insignificant few years. And that, of course, it also leaves its mark, puts its mark on society, stamps society forever as it stamps it now. Well, I think that's it on my part at the moment. Unless you want me to talk about something more specific, or unless you have no questions.
Career.
No, but it's not. I mean,
I admit that something that
happened to me is, although it was quite routine at that time, it no longer sounds like a routine.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And
my American career is just got thousands and thousands of people who got a PhD and taught.
I remember the other interview when you started referring to the fact that you first came to France and then spoke French very well and you considered to be a French intellectual.
Yeah.
And then you became an American intellectual, and then as it seemed to me that your political views changed as well from the high school kid and his excursions and then became an academic, so gradual movement to the left. Or I don't know, I don't want to frame it, but that's really interesting.
Am I talking now? Yeah. No, but you said that you have questions or something.
Well, that's a question.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's the question.
I mean, for an English speaking audience, this is sort of because you aren't just an American academic who got a PhD coming from another country, you're one of the founders of an entire field. Whether you've thought systematically about.
Well, it's the field that founded me, not.
Yeah. There wasn't really one before that, not really. So, to the extent that your experiences track very much the evolution of our field, I think it's quite important. Yeah.
So what should we do now?
We'll start in 1945.
I think that we should go back to take 1945 a little bit later, even later today or another period. I would rather that you, while you were listening to me with even a few notes, whether and can amplify things, whether left out things, and then we come to what Mate is talking about. That I admit, it's a fascinating question of how one changes with times. Of course, one tempora mutatur and nos mutamus in illis. So nos mutamur in illis. So we change with them. Not that much. I changed, but my political views, for instance, in my opinion, developed when I was a high school student. I basically didn't change, which is not very glorious. I wish I had been more imaginative.
Well, but let's talk about that, because one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is whether in your family life, your father or mother ever talked about politics or how they felt about what was going on. I mean, you mentioned that your father was a soldier in
Politics only came up in terms of how is it going to affect our life. So Nazism is something which we reject. But I never heard a discussion whether the Liberal Party was better than the non-Liberal Party. No. In general, political ideologies didn't come up, or at least I don't remember them. Well, first of all, my mother didn't have political views. That I really I'm quite sure. She didn't talk about it. My father would have had a general liberal, conservative liberal interpretation of history and of politics, the kind that Hungary practiced before 1914, to which his group would have been very loyal, but obviously not to the ferociously independent-minded Independence Party, but 67ers and not 48ers, because it was for a quiet, peaceful life, obedience to the law, respecting authority. But I never heard my father, he might have, he just didn't discuss it. What he thought of Tisza István, or what he thought of, obviously he had a better opinion of Bethlen than Gombrich, but I just surmised this, that Bethlen, he would have seen Bethlen as a sort of a reincarnation of the pre-1914 liberal conservative regime, like sort of Tisza Kálmán, Tisza István type of person who is very tolerant toward Jews, for instance, although much less tolerant toward the ethnic minorities. I don't think that my mother, I have heard my father mention ethnic minorities as a problem. I really can't, it is so negative that I am embarrassed about it, but I can't recall any instance when my father would have talked about how whether we should reconquer the lost territories. I would have to invent this. Oh, yes, I was with him. We went to Transylvania more than once. I'm sure not for political reasons, not for nationalist reasons, we remitted the re-annexed territories as soon as possible. So we were in Kosovo in the northern Hungary in 1939, maybe, for an excursion. Then in the same year or the next year, I cannot recall, we went to Karpatoya, that is to Ruthenia, and then maybe 41 we went first to Transylvania. Now let me try to recall that. The last time I was in Transylvania on my own was in 1943 when I worked in Korond when I was 13, then 17. In Korond, my father said in 43, you have to learn a profession, you know what world we live in, at least you should have a profession. I have, through the Ipanmivisit Tashulat, I can easily get you a position as an intern and in a ceramics factory in Korond. And so I went to Korond and spent the whole summer trying to make pots and pans. You know Korond?
Yeah, I was there.
You lived in Korond?
I know, I was there, I just visited.
Yeah. Bertalan Aron Keramia Mühely. That was the largest. It was a very nice time. But that was there, I was there definitely with the purpose of learning a profession. I learned a little bit. I don't think that I could have made a pot on my own under any circumstances. But especially not a vase. The vase is Korond vase is blue. You remember that? I could never, I couldn't, I didn't have enough talent for that, whereas every peasant kid made them there. 42.
Do you remember anything about that experience in 43? You were there for the whole summer, about the atmosphere, were there non-Hungarians working in Korond, or did people talk about?
Well, they talked about the Romanian times, the Székely, with whom I worked, they talked about it as how they didn't like it, not much more than that. I remember. They came, the gendarmes came and do this and that. I don't remember very much about it. They talked mostly about fight amongst Székelyes, that the different villages, and they had fights on Saturday night. They were drinking and they were using their knives. And who was that time when I was there? There were big fights. And the Hungarian gendarmes came because there was a fight and people were stabbed. But whether they talked about the ruin, we were using latrines and there was nothing else. In the latrine there was paper, and the paper was not newspaper, not terrible paper, but school books, textbooks. And I showed them what some of the people that I saw there, which was Romanian history, really. In Romania, I can understand. Even then, that time, I could understand Romanian. And it was extolling Michal Viteazul, and so the same story. And they said, that's where it belongs, to the latrine. So that I didn't hear anyone, unlike you who found the inclusion, I didn't find heard of anyone who would have expressed any longing for the Romanian regime. But nothing, I didn't really hear. Politics, I don't remember that. The owner, Bertalan Aron, and his sons were Hungarian. Quite Hungarian. They were Hungarian nationalists, that I remember. the workers, they mostly talked about sex. I'm very sorry. The workers among themselves, men and women, talked about sex. It's of course, to me, that was the experience of my lifetime, because I knew absolutely nothing. And women came in, and the men gave them penises which were made out of ceramics. And the women were very, very pleased. One woman came in and said, yeah, it's a big one. They were rather down to earth, those people. They made fun of me because they called me an Urfi. Urfi. I had shorts, whereas they were stockings. I was still wearing sacred stockings. I was taller than anybody there. I wasn't very tall, but I was certainly taller than those Seikai workers. So, Jareda Urfi, but they were not unnice. I don't have any memory of being mistreated. But obviously I was not part of their society. They tolerated me because Bertel and Aaron, the owner, said, here is this Urfi and treat him decently. I really can't answer this question. What I can answer is how the Hungarians behaved there. Now, 42, when we were walking all the way from Gimes, Gimes is Soros in any case, over the mountains down to Cheek and to almost to Háromszék. Always over the mountains, and then we went to the hills, or sometimes once or twice we stayed in a chalet. There were very few of them, and they were terrible. But it was a great time. We walked for several weeks, and there, we in the mountains. I thought we would make Seikais, but no. In the mountains, you met mostly Romanian shepherds, with whom we had difficulties communicating, not so much because we didn't understand any Romanian, but because they were so primitive that you couldn't get any half the intelligent information out of them. We asked, how far is the next village? And I said, he didn't answer, didn't understand the question. I said, 3 kilometers, 4 kilometers? And I said, yes. Everything was yes. And it turned out to be 20 kilometers. They had no idea of distances, for instance. Any case, that's unimportant. What we found is that when, for instance, we went to the Gyergyószentmiklós, from Gyergyószentmiklós, we started in Gyergyószentmiklós, over the Csiki Mountains, we went to the Gyimesi Soros. And there we ended up in a village, Gyimesbük. And in Gyimesbük, we had no lodgings. And we met an army officer who was one of the young men who had courted my sister. My sister was with me. He was very friendly, very polite, was very happy. And he said, no problem. We will get you an accommodation. They were building fortifications against Romania, which is really very funny, but theoretically against the Russians, but in reality, we all knew that it was against the Romanians. He went into the best house in Gyimesbük. There was an old Seikai couple there. And he said, this, ezek az urak, itt fognak aludni. They will sleep here. You get out. And he threw them out. And so that showed me, by the way, that the army is behaving abominably. And there were similar instances which we experienced, that the army behaves abominably, not only toward Jews, but toward everybody. Everybody who is not a Hungarian upper-class person. They treated their soldiers badly. Why do I think that, for instance, the Germans were superior? Why have I had this feeling? Because the Germans were not hitting their soldiers. The Hungarian officers were hitting their soldiers in front of other people. Or they talked to them like they were dirt. Terrible. Terrible how they treated them. I guess my father took it for granted. This is that. I'm afraid, but I really don't know. I don't remember. He was very unhappy about this business of the old Seke couple being kicked out, and we went after them and asked them to come back, and we said that we will sleep in the Seru. What's the Seru? We said Seru in the haystack. Hayloft, in the hayloft. And they said, no, they will sleep in the hayloft. So we slept on the floor. It wasn't so comfortable. The hayloft would have been much better because we did not take the bed. There were just Tista Soba, those very beautiful beds with 100 pillows. And that would have been equally uncomfortable. But that was an everyday problem of where do you sleep, because life was very complicated. But now their father definitely did not like that situation. But otherwise, the treatment, I'm sure that he didn't like it. But I just don't remember specifically whether he said anything.
Could I have a question about your family?
To a certain degree, yes, in that my parents favored non-Jewish young men for my sister, which is partly because we wanted to be part of Hungarian society, but partly it was opportunistic or practical, pragmatic. If my sister had been able to marry during the war, she would have been safe. So it was a question of survival then.